From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. David Duchovny gets around. Special Agent Fox Mulder solving paranormal FBI cases in the X-Files. Transvestite DEA agent Denise Bryson in Twin Peaks. Bad boy writer Hank Moody in Californication. Lately, he's been making music, working on Aquarius, where he'll play a TV detective in the 1960s chasing Charles Manson, and he's out with a book, his first, a novel, a cheeky, jokey, half-serious fable about a sassy cow, a Jewish pig, and a suave turkey running for their lives. This hour On Point, we're talking with actor, now author, David Duchovny, two-time Golden Globe-winning actor for the roles of novelist Hank Moody in Californication and Special Agent Fox Mulder in The X-Files. Screenwriter, director, now author. His debut novel is Holy Cow. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Duchovny, it's great to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Is this what you do when it's off-season, when you're filming, I don't know, TV shows, sit around and write novels, a novel?
Well, this came about being in the business that I'm in, show business. If I ever am lucky enough to have an idea, and that they don't come that often, I ask of that idea, are you a movie, first of all, because that's the business I'm in. So I was driving probably about 10 years ago in L.A., and I thought, if I were a cow, I'd probably want to get to India. So that was just the germ of the whole thing, and I thought, well, that seems like an animated movie if I can flesh it out. So neat other characters. Came up with a pig who would try to get to Israel because of kosher laws, and then Turkey, who was benightedly thinking that the country was named after him. So they would try to get to these places. Sounded like a road movie. Pitched it at Disney and Pixar, and they were shying away from a movie in which a pig gets circumcised, which I kind of understood. You know, Disney's interesting to me because it's okay to kill a parent in front of a child, but not okay to circumcise a pig. Well, you know, that's a different moral scale than I have. And I just put it away, filed it away in my mind, really, because there wasn't much on paper. And then last year, I just woke up one morning and I was bemoaning the fact that I had never written an extended piece of fiction. And I'd always thought that I would and wanted to. And I the idea came back to me, and I thought I never really fleshed it out. I never really saw what that story was. Why don't I try to write it? And because it felt young, because it felt like it was aimed not only at an adult audience but also at kids, I think it was a liberating kind of a voice for me to try to inhabit this first time out. And I didn't feel as much pressure to, you know, try to write the great American novel.
Everybody knows you from maybe different performances. Some may know you from all. I mean, they've, you know, from Twin Peaks on, it's been pretty prominent, pretty out there. I missed X-Files somehow. That just blew past me. Maybe I was out of the country. I don't know. But I know you from California.
You're out of the country for 9 years.
Well, 10, actually. yeah, it was a long run, I admit. Yeah. I missed you. But I knew you pretty well from Californication.
Yeah.
And I was reading Holy Cow. I was just struck by how much of the voice in this book seemed very recognizable to me from Hank Moody, your character in Californication. How does that happen? Does that mean you were ad-libbing in Californication, or you were sort of juicing your view of the world into the screenwriters, or it was washing back into Holy Cow? Why would I hear that voice in both?
Well, that's a question for you to answer, I think, but also...
It's on the page.
I think probably it's the character washing back. You know, Tom Kapanos wrote pretty much every word, at least the last 4 or 5 years that we did on that show. There wasn't a lot of improvising, and it's a voice that kind of got into my head. I personally have not made that connection, but you know, there's certain kind of modern or contemporary lingo that goes on in the book that certainly Hank Moody was facile with. You know, I guess you could say it's a little bit of that filtered through the voice of a 15-year-old girl at the same time.
15-year-old girl, what that is through your kind of your daughter's voice you're channeling there, or this young cow,
yeah,
Elsie Bovary.
Well, she would kill me if I said that was her voice. So yes. Even if it were, I wouldn't admit it to you.
Plausible deniability.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of high-spiritedness to Elsie that certainly, you know, jaded Hank Moody doesn't have, but is infused by the fact that, you know, obviously it's not how I think cows think. I don't actually believe in that part. This is, you know, this is a child. This is a young consciousness narrating this book, and it's really in a way it's a coming of age story for a young person. It's that moment when a human being realizes that it's going to die. You know, in this case, it's a cow that realizes it's going to be slaughtered, and then that's really the loss of innocence for us human beings when we realize that our parents are going to die, or when we're going to die, or both. And what do we do in reaction? We try and get to a safe place where we'll never have to die, where we'll be worshipped, where we'll be holy, where either, you know, could be through fame, could be through money, just some kind of power that's going to cheat death. And that's kind of what the book is about underneath it all.
It's a road trip. It's a romp. It has Elsie Bovary, the cow, looking through the farmer's window at the TV and seeing what goes on in a slaughterhouse and her sort of rosy view of life is shattered right there. She's got to get out of there. She's got to get to India. Mm-hmm. You want to read a little bit for us,
sure,
David?
Sure.
They what, to get into their camouflage, into their costumes, and posing as humans, and hit the world of international air travel, this cow, yes, pig, and turkey.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of suspension of disbelief that you need to read this book,
or maybe a
or
lot.
Any fable,
right. Or just to
or
live.
Any fable, really. Yeah. And that was part of the fun of writing it. This is chapter 31. There's a lot of chapters, a lot of short chapters, because it's fun to name them. And this one is called a Terminal Case. This is where the animals have made it through. They've escaped from the farm, and now they are they're at the airport, where their disguises as people is working, and that's what's going on here. They're trying to get to the cow's trying to get a flight to India, the pig's trying to get a flight to Israel, and the turkey's trying to get a flight to Turkey. So they're all trying to figure out. They're about to split up.
Hit it.
The airport terminal was very big and confusing, but we knew we had to make it to one of those automated ticket machines. Tom, that's the turkey, was still in denial. Maybe I'll just glide myself to Turkey. Who needs a plane? I protested. No, Tom, we need your beak. Neither Shalom, that's the pig, nor I have prehensile fingers. Your beak is the nearest thing we have to a finger. Please don't glide away. Okay, friend, for you, I will temporarily ground Air Turkey. I appreciate that, I said as we entered the terminal. I was so happy our disguises were working. I'm sure we made for an interesting sight. Big old me, well over 6 feet on my hind legs. Oi, as Shalom would say, was my back killing me. In a beige raincoat and sunglasses, and Shalom dressed in the velvet pants of a little schoolboy holding our pet turkey by the leash. We had the foresight to register Tom as a comfort turkey, an emotional support fowl. There was a program where you could get your dog permitted to travel in the cabin with you rather than in storage to comfort you if you were a nervous flyer, and we were able to get Tom the same accreditation online. He had taken the course on the phone and had learned some rudimentary therapeutic insights, which made him very annoying. He kept lapsing into a German accent and saying things like, "That pig has ein edible complex," or "Tell me about your mother." He told me the pain in my hooves was all in my head, and I told him the pain in my hooves was going to be all in his butt if he didn't quit it. Apparently you are having some transference resistance. I should get a pipe. Would you respect me more if I smoked a pipe? He asked me. Tom's other problem was that the leash made him very nervous and sweaty. Anything around his neck made him nervous, and I understood. His greatest primal fear, one that was in his DNA, passed down from centuries of turkeys that had endured the peculiar American custom of Thanksgiving, was of the chopping block. His neck, stretched out long and the blade glinting through the air, coming down at light speed, his truncated life flashing before his eyes. "Shut up," Tom barked. I hadn't realized I'd been saying that last bit out loud. "My bad," I apologized as we approached the automated ticket dispenser. Tom continued to tug at the leash around his neck like Rodney Dangerfield in his heyday. Shalom was getting his jollies, treating Tom like a dog, saying things like heel and good boy. Referring to the phone, I relayed Tom the confirmation numbers for our reservations, and he pecked at them on the computer screen. It went off without a hitch. All our planning was paying off. Like magic, the printed boarding passes slid slowly out of the mouth of the screen. 1, 2, 3. To us, they looked like winning lottery tickets, because that's what they were.
David Duchovny reading from his new novel, kind of a fable there, Animals Flying Off, Holy Cow. There's a thanks in here to professors at Princeton or Yale or both. You did a BA in English at Princeton and worked on a PhD at Yale. Is this where they thought you were heading?
Where they thought I was heading? Probably the woman that I thank in the acknowledgments, Maria DiBattista, who's still a professor at Princeton. I think she would have wanted for me to continue writing. She was very supportive. I like to say that, when she first read my writing, she suggested that I go into acting, but it's not actually true. She was very encouraging and supportive and still is. I'm doing a reading tonight, and I hope that Maria can come by. I haven't seen her in a while.
It's great to make those connections. We're talking this hour with David Duchovny, actor from Twin Peaks, The X-Files, Californication. Twin Peaks may come back. Here he was. It was in 3 episodes of the 1990s show, played DEA agent Dennis or Denise Bryson, agent and transvestite who arrives in Twin Peaks with special agent Dale Cooper, played by Kyle MacLachlan, being investigated by his employers.
Dennis Bryson and I work together in Oakland. He's one of the finest minds in the DEA. Harry, we're in very good hands.
Coop.
Dennis?
It's a long story, but actually I prefer Denise, if you don't mind.
Okay.
All the way back to Twin Peaks. David Duchovny, give us some context. There's a lot going on in your life right now. Are they really bringing Twin Peaks back?
That's what I'm told. I love Kyle MacLachlan's response.
Okay. Okay, fine. We can do it in Twin
it's
Peaks.
So Twin
anything
Peaks.
Goes.
Yeah, an old friend of mine just walked in a dress and a wig. Okay.
No problem.
Yeah. I'm told Twin Peaks is coming back. That's all I've heard. And when I heard that, I had people that I work with reach out and say, I'd love to come back and put on the dress and wear the pantyhose if they'll have me. So it's something that I'd enjoy doing.
How does this work in that world, David? You hear it, you read in Variety that it may happen. They haven't even spoken with you yet. I mean, they've got some of the main actors lined up there, but you just wait to see whether you're written in or not?
Well, there's no rules about it. If I was a main character on the show, I'm sure I would have known about it long ago as they were preparing to do it. But I don't know if they were thinking of having my character come back. I'm sure they have a lot of characters they have to service. There was a wide canvas on that show. So I just said, just give them a call and say I'm interested. If they're interested, I'd love to do one. That's all. And if they do, that'd be great. And if they don't, I wish them luck. I'm looking forward to seeing the show as well.
You did 3 episodes of Twin Peaks, and then X-Files, of course, exploded. I mean, we can hear the youth of your voice just in that little line
there.
Yeah,
I know.
Boy, David.
Yeah.
What was in your head at that point thinking about an acting career? Has it turned out anything like you expected?
If there'd been more in my head, I think I would have quit, because...
Why?
The odds are so terrible for an actor. There's so few people that are able to make a living compared to the people that can't. So if I'd really sat down and thought about that, I might have paralyzed myself. But getting that particular role, that role was written, I believe it was written by Mark Frost, and I believe the character was either thought of, or I know it was written for James Spader. Mm-hmm. And Spader had to drop out for whatever reason, scheduling. So they opened it up to casting. And, I was going for anything that came my way at that point. I would have read for anything. So Twin Peaks was a great thing. It was a big show. I went in and I can't believe it. I got it. I never got anything at first. I used to audition for television, and they'd say, oh, he's a movie actor. You know, he's a movie actor. And I'm like, well, where are the movies that I'm going to do then?
Yeah.
So I just found myself on set all of a sudden being asked to narrow my legs. Again, I kind of just walk blindly into situations and let the chips fall where they may. And that's what happened with Denise. It just kind of did the whole thing by instinct and feel and had a great time.
All the way back in Twin Peaks days. It may come back. David Duchovny could be in it. He's out with a new novel right now. It's called Holy Cow. David, a lot of callers for you. Bruce in Portland, Tennessee. Bruce, you're on the air with David Duchovny.
Well, hi there. I just wanted to say Dave is so charismatic. It doesn't matter how bad the trouble he gets into on Californication. He just gives you that little smile and all is forgiven. And I've been watching him ever since his beginning and just really like him. And thanks, guys.
Thank you, Bruce.
Bruce, thank you. Crack that smile and get away with it. There's a lot of that. It has to cover a lot in Californication. Here's a little bit. Hank Moody, famous writer with an appetite for sex, who is stuck in life.
You're out there touching anything that moves. You're not writing. You have this incredible talent, and you're just flushing it down the toilet.
What's going on with you, man?
I'm disgusted with my life.
As your friend and agent, may I suggest that you start looking for a nice girl?
I wouldn't even know what to say to a nice girl.
From the California trailer there, no longer that boy voice of early Twin Peaks. But you hear Bruce right there. He calls it, he gives you charisma. You've certainly got it. What is that brand of charm that lets you get away with such stuff as a character when you go to work, David? You must think
about it. That it's something that I don't think about, you know. Obviously, I don't sit around thinking, what is your charisma, David?
No.
Let's talk about you.
Character, then. You know, like what you're going to line up with and what you're not.
I will try to answer.
Yeah.
In terms of Hank Moody and probably many characters that I've played, just off the top of my head, probably Fox Mulder, too. Mm-hmm. I try to find the unapologetic place of the character, which I find charismatic in people in life, people mm-hmm. who are themselves in every situation, regardless of the consequences. And, you know, people will say, well, your character is not likable on the page, or, you know, I don't like what he's doing. And to me, that's interesting. You know, in drama, we kind of want to see people doing what we're not doing often. And to make him real, in terms, if you're talking about Hank Moody, mm-hmm. to make him real, I decided that I wasn't going to apologize for anything. And that's the way he was written. And he's a truth teller. He does not lie. He does what he does and then cops to it. And the consequences are usually pretty bad. So that's a certain kind of power in life. There's no hypocrisy to Hank Moody. And I think that's in essence, maybe the charisma of that character. And Mulder's the same. You know, he's a joke in the FBI. He chases after UFOs. That's ridiculous. But he doesn't hide it, and he doesn't apologize.
I really loved the Hank Moody character in Californication. It was the first time I really watched you over any length of time. And mm-hmm. the truth-telling was awesome. Piece of it, I didn't know that much about your personal life. But when I read for the show today, it looked to me like you had a lot of intersecting stuff going on here. I mean, you had your marriage was facing its problems. Lots of people's do, but during that same time that you're playing a guy with a difficult marriage in Californication, you got kids kind of the same age. Here you were coming up and writing a book. You're a writer there. I mean, how does the interplay of real life and something that you must have felt it nipping kind of close to your actual life, and then the fiction on screen. How do those? What's the interplay? How's that work?
It doesn't really ever occur to me to be honest with you. I know that probably doesn't sound like an honest answer, but
it doesn't. It seems impossible for a truth teller. I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't. But it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm telling you, it's an honest answer. I go to work. If I go to work doing Californication, my eye is on making it funny and making it real. What the character is doing is completely unimportant to me. It's as unimportant as what clothes he's wearing. I didn't have to think about aliens in order to play Fox Mulder. I didn't have to think about whatever Hank Moody is thinking about to play Hank Moody. I'm playing the emotional truth of the character. The words are on the surface. The actions are on the surface. What's unfortunate is if there is ever any lining up between my personal life or an actor's personal life and the part that he plays, people generally try to draw that straight line. And, you know, that's just what I think of as a hazard of the job. It's a painful part of the job because it's never what it seems at all. And but it's hard to explain the process of acting.
I think non-actors would look at it and say that access to that emotional truth surely is rooted in life somewhere. I mean, how else does an actor learn what that emotional truth might look like?
Well,
feel
there
like?
aren't human emotion is not that complicated. There aren't that many of them. There's only a handful. We all know them. We've all had them. We're all living the same kind of life. Anybody could act a part if they tried, if they had talent, if they had the inclination. Walt Whitman said, "Nothing human is foreign to me." That's true to every human. So, as I said, the specifics of what a character is doing are really just the things floating on the surface of that work. Underneath that work, you're working with a handful of human emotions that everybody has, and you're trying to fill it up honestly in those moments.
David Duchovny is with us. His new novel, his first, is Holy Cow, excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Donna, in Atlanta, Georgia, you are on with David Duchovny.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Duchovny. I learned about your book in the New York Times, and I didn't know much about it until I just now have heard you read, and I love it. I was just laughing my head off. I didn't know who was reading it. I just kind of turned the radio on during your reading, and I have to own it now. But I'm just sort of glad that as an actor, I know you're highly intelligent. I've followed your career, and so I'm just glad that as an actor, your writing is intelligent and sounds like it's for adults and kids. And thanks for writing.
Thank you. That would be my hope. Would be that it's kind of a book that an adult might read to a kid. You know, that it would span both those experiences. And you know, writing it, I felt a certain kind of freedom. Because it wasn't my day job in a way. I knew that my kids would still be able to eat if everybody in the world hated my damn book. You know, so I got to kind of write it the way I wanted to, and hopefully what you're responding to is that I had a good time writing it, and that translates to people reading it.
Donna, thanks for calling. David, how do you get from your senior thesis at Princeton, the schizophrenic critique of pure reason in Beckett's early novels, to Holy Cow?
It's an obvious straight line, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Talking cows flying on airplanes.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, that's so long ago for me to have written about Beckett's novels. That's when I was 21.
Yeah.
You know, I was interested in going on to graduate school at that point, and you know, I was my senior thesis is in place of a course at Princeton. You can not take a course and work on basically what is a paper your entire year. So that was a book-length book of criticism on, I guess, the five Beckett novels that I can think of offhand. And I have no idea what it was like, or I have vague memories of what it was about. I think some of the ideas stayed with me in a way, and I think some of the ideas are kind of intuitive to me, and therefore probably are floating around Holy Cow or anything that I might do or write. So there probably is some of it in there in terms of a rejection of normal thinking of society, I would say.
What about your humor? Was it always around? You've got this wonderful sort of sardonic, wry, way of playing with reality. Mm-hmm. It's funny. Does it come? Is it your mom's? Is it your dad's? Is it your own stripe? Where does it come from?
Well, I think it's both my parents in a way. My father he died a number of years ago. He lived in Boston for a while, mm-hmm. actually. He worked at Brandeis University. And he was Jewish and had a certain kind of ironic Jewish sense of humor and sensibility. He used to tell me that Yiddish was such a great language because everything meant the opposite of what it said. It was an actual ironic language. If you wanted to insult someone, you call them a prime minister.
Right.
So that would be his subversive.
Okay.
You know, Jews have been the underclass throughout history and repressed. So their language is in code, and their humor is subversive. Mm. My mother is she's a Lutheran. She kind of yelled at me the other day and said she wasn't, but I'm pretty sure she's a Lutheran. From Scotland.
Yeah.
And they have their own brand of subversive humor, having been under the thumb of the English for most of their history. Mm-hmm. They are also a downtrodden race. So I think from both of those, and I get maybe a bit of non-American type of humor from my mother. British humor.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, having been raised by those two downtrodden strains of culture, I think maybe that's my own particular brand of subversion.
How did they meet? Was she the immigrant? Was your dad's family already in the U.S.?
They met in Rome. My father had served in World War II, and he went on the GI Bill to go to Europe, and I believe they were both teaching. I could be getting this all wrong, and you're going to get me.
Not a Lutheran, not teaching,
again.
Not in Rome.
They were both teaching at the Berlitz School. They were teaching English together, or they met there. And then they moved back to New York and started a family. And my brother was born first, and then me.
Are the reviews in yet from your mom on Holy Cow?
You know, it's probably the only one that I care about. I don't read reviews. I haven't for a number of years because, I don't remember the good ones, only the bad ones.
Right.
So what's the use? And it gets in my head, and it's there's some stuff that I can't shake out to this day.
Yeah.
So my mother, she has always wanted me to finish my dissertation, for one. And I
still? Get back to Yale. Write that dissertation.
So the fact that I wrote a novel was very, very satisfying to her. And she loved it. She thought it was very sad and funny.
David Duchovny, stand by. We've got a lot of listeners for you. We'll go to them after a break. Actor, now writer, David Duchovny. His new book is Holy Cow, a kind of a fable for adults, for children, road trip, romp. Traveling animals looking for a better life. I'm Tom Ashbrook with David Duchovny. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with actor, now writer, David Duchovny. His first book, new book, Holy Cow, just out. It's about a cow, a pig named Shalom, and a turkey named Tom. Of course, cow is Elsie Bovary, no less. On the road looking for redemption in India or Israel, or for the turkey, Turkey, of course. He's got Aquarius coming out soon, a detective on the trail of Charles Manson in the time before the famous murders. Some music in the future here with David Duchovny as well. He joins us from New York. Here's a little bit from the pilot episode all the way back, 1993, X-Files, Agent Dana Scully, played by Gillian Anderson, working with Agent Fox Mulder, played by David Duchovny, on a case from the X-Files. Paranormal FBI cases trying to solve the murder of four high school class members. And Agent Mulder has a theory.
I don't think you're ready for what I think.
I'm here to solve this case, Mulder. I want the truth.
The truth? I think those kids have been abducted.
By who?
By what?
You don't really believe that.
Do you have a better explanation?
By who, by what, and we're in X-Files territory. Coming up next month, we got some music coming, a new debut album, Hell or High Water. Here's David Duchovny on guitar with his song Let It Rain, just a little bit. New book, new album coming out. new shows coming out, and maybe old ones as well. Justin in Clayton, New York, you're on with David Duchovny.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And Mr. Duchovny, it's wow, what a privilege to get to talk to you today, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Of course, huge fan of The X-Files and your work on that show. Loved all 9 seasons. Was sad to see it go. But what really turned me on to you was your appearance on Saturday Night Live, especially when you did your impersonation of Jeff Goldblum. I'd love to hear your experience on that show, because that made my friend actually run to the bathroom to avoid wetting his pants.
Wow.
Highest praise.
Yeah, for sure. I think I'm still the only person ever to attempt a Jeff Goldblum imitation. When you do SNL, and it is as much fun as it looks, also terrifying, especially the first time. But when you do it, you kind of have a meeting with everybody and Lorne Michaels in a room, and they ask you, is there anything you'd like to do? Do you dance? Do you sing? Do you do any imitations? You know, and they'll tailor it for you if they think it's funny or good. And I said, well, I do a Richard Gere imitation, and I think I do a Jeff Goldblum imitation. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. And they thought that was funny, because nobody does that imitation. And I didn't really know what I meant by doing a Jeff Goldblum imitation. It wasn't something that I could really do specifically. It was more of a feeling. Therefore, sometimes when I did it, it sucked terribly. And sometimes when I did it, it was really good. And I couldn't tell you what the difference was. And that was terrifying.
Was it mainly voice or face or body? Or how do you remember?
It was mostly the hands.
Yeah.
It was the hands. It was the use of the hands when speaking, and a very, very specific way the hands are used.
It
was all in the hands.
it sent Justin's friend running. Did you know that you crushed it while you were doing it?
I didn't know. I had no idea. I still don't to this day. You know, it's just, I think what it is, it's just a funny thing. And whether or not it's like a very specifically good Goldblum is not really the point. It's just a funny thing to be doing.
Questions for you online. Vote for Callie asks on Twitter, people watch celebrities, actors very closely. This listener says, you're always wearing a medallion these days. What's it mean?
Oh, it's a St. Christopher medal that was given to me by Tay and my kids years ago, and I've been doing a lot of traveling, so I've been wearing it, and it's keeping me safe. Even though I'm a non-Christian, non-Jew, I still I'll take St. Christopher with me.
A non-this and a non-that.
Yeah.
David Duchovny in his own territory. Davin says, do you see X-Files as a blessing or curse to your creative career? I'm not sure what the push in that question is, but let's just take it on its face.
Well, I think what he's asking is in terms of typecasting, mm-hmm. or probably that. You know, in terms of that, I don't think of it as a curse at all. You know, I think when I was doing it, I felt like, how am I going to get out from under this thing? It's huge. But over time, you know, you just keep swinging and you keep doing what you do and try to change and do good work. And eventually people are going to accept the work that you do and hopefully not compare it to something that you've done in the past. So my feelings about The X-Files are still just really fond, and I owe so much to it. The obvious stuff, you know, being able to do more work because of it. But much less obvious is that I can even tell from that clip you played, just my voice. I was not a seasoned actor. I did not know what I was doing, even though I thought that I did. And the chance to get up every day and work as an actor, even doing the same role as an actor, 12 to 14 hours a day, year after year, I schooled myself. I figured out along the way, for better or for worse, how I work, what kind of actor I can be, what I can access, what I want to access. So that was all going on. You know, while I was getting paid to do this great show, I was also having an education.
I've read you saying something about that work ethic and that just nose on the grindstone helped you figure out your capacity and your limitations and work creatively with both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, unless you're Shakespeare, you have limitations.
We've all got them, sure.
Yeah. He's the only one. Shakespeare, Michael Jordan, and Meryl Streep.
There you go. Sam in Miami, Florida. You're on the air with David Duchovny. Thanks for calling, Sam.
Hello, Tom. I wasn't so much a David Duchovny fan. I mean, I watched him, I guess, on the reruns of The X-Files, but I've never been into the other shows. But his whole book, which I haven't read, but I got to go out and buy now, reminds me of something that 40 years ago, when I lived briefly in the Bahamas for 7 years, we built a synagogue, and a year later we published, as a fundraiser, a cookbook called the Bahamish Cookbook, which is a combination of Bahamian and Hamish, meaning homelike. Okay. And we warned people that at the back section, there was a non-kosher section of Bahamian recipes, including conch. And the joke was, if you want a kosher, you got to catch it and circumcise it. If you have a reprise or something, a follow-up to the book, you can add Conky Joe the Conk. What can I tell you?
Sam, I think you're the ideal reader for Holy Cow there in Miami. I mean, you take your pig named Shalom, you send him to Israel, and his first thing he's doing is looking for a moil to get circumcised there. What?
Yeah. Well, you know, he wants to fit in like any pig would want to. Yeah.
But he feels safe because he's not kosher. He won't be eaten.
He'd rather be hated than be eaten.
You quote Charles Darwin in the front piece here. Sam in Miami, thank you for those
yes,
stories.
Thank you. That was
awesome.
That was hysterical, Sam. Thank you.
You quote Darwin saying, the difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is, certainly is one of degree and not of kind. But your cow, Elsie, just doesn't get human. She says, humans love us, or I thought so. We all thought so before she sees how slaughterhouses work. She says, they love our milk. And then, now personally, your character says, I think it's a little weird to drink another animal's milk. You don't see me walking up to some human lady who just gave birth saying, yo, can I get a taste? That sounded very Duchovny, very Hank Moody Duchovny.
Maybe
I don't know.
Maybe I slipped out of Elsie there for a moment.
Boy, Charlie in Detroit, Michigan. Charlie, you're on the air with David Duchovny.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, David.
Hi.
Hey, I'm an X-Files fan from way back, but actually my question has little to do with that in particular. I'm also in the Detroit area here. I'm an actor, musician, and writer, and I'm just curious, talking to someone who's had success in all three areas, what would you, if you could start over again, what do you find is the most fulfilling? What did you enjoy the most, the acting, the writing, or playing your instrument?
You may be a little early on the success in music front, maybe even the writing front. We'll see how Holy Cow does, but you're doing all, David. What about it?
Yeah. I couldn't compare. That they're such very different expressive ways of expressing oneself. I think, you know, I think the newer ventures for me, I guess I'm more in touch again with my limitations and my naivete and my newness, and that's kind of exciting to be pushing against something that's new again. Whereas I've been an actor for a number of years, and even though there are new roles, there's something that I know very well about it. So I wouldn't be able to tell you which is the most enjoyable. I think, you know, in the moment, they're all enjoyable when they're going well. When you're acting, there's a certain kind of suspension of time when it's going well. I've heard athletes talk about the play slowing down. That you get that feeling as an actor sometimes when it's going well, like everything is slowing down except you. And then as a writer, you can get into a zone where, you know, a couple hours can go by and you forget about the day, you forget about everything, and you're just writing. You're kind of being spoken through for a while, and then you come back down to earth and you realize you were in a nice place for a while. And then music, obviously, people get transported by music probably more easily than any of those things. So I think when they're working, when they're enjoyable, there's a certain loss of yourself and a suspension of time, and that is really a high.
Your buddy Brad Davidson calls the album "Hell or High Water" coming out next month a little Dylan-esque, a little Lou Reed, a little REM. What were you going for?
I was just going for, you know, what do I do? You know, those are guys that I like a lot. So I'm sure I've been influenced my whole life listening to those people.
You sing and play guitar here with backup from Berklee School of Music?
Yeah, musicians? I play guitar, but I don't play it well enough to play on my own album. I wrote the songs. And I wrote the guitar, but I, like I said, I'm self-taught and I haven't been playing that long. And, I could play in public and it would sound okay, but it doesn't sound good enough for an album. These kids from Berklee, terrific musicians, and they're playing the instruments.
Jason in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you're on with David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call today. It's great to be able to talk to David today.
What's your question?
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, with all the different creative endeavors you're involved with, what inspires you? What other actors or artists or writers do you look to for inspiration?
Huh. I don't look to a person habitually. I'll get inspired by a performance or by some music or by a painting or by some writing, but it's rare that I keep coming back to somebody to look for inspiration. It's really individual works and less the actual authors, actors, singers. I enjoy so much of in all those fields that I don't know. I mean, if you ask about inspiration, oddly enough, my own father, he published his first book when he was 73. So in a way, he's been a symbol of stubbornness and perseverance to me, which is inspiring. So I find the ability to get back up and keep trying to be inspiring. So I'm usually inspired by people that fail and keep going. I wouldn't know how to name them, but that's usually the pattern that I get inspired by.
Sounds honest. Ray in North Kingston, Rhode Island. You're on, Ray.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, David.
It's
a pleasure. First of all, I think you were brilliant in Twin Peaks, but something I've always wondered about in your world is, when you work on something like a long season running, The X-Files, and you obviously develop friendships and bonds, do those friendships and bonds endure after the after it's over?
Yes, they often do. Sometimes they don't. Acting on a movie or a television show can be a little like summer camp. You know, you make best friends right away, and then winter rolls around, and you don't really see them anymore. But certainly for me, the two long running shows that I've had, X-Files and Californication, I'm good friends with Chris Carter and Gillian Anderson, and Natasha McElhone and Pam Adlon from Californication, Evan Handler, Tom Kapanos. These are all friends that I'll have going forward in my life as far as I can see. So it's an intense experience to go to work every day for that amount of hours and for that many years. So, you know, there's a certain kind of battle camaraderie that you develop with people that you work that closely with, and you get to know them really well, and they you, and there's an intimacy that develops, and I don't think will ever go away.
Next up on NBC, Aquarius, you play a police detective on the trail of serial killer Charles Manson back in the 1960s. Will we recognize this Duchovny character?
I hope not. You know, you're always, one is always trying to reinvent. I'm stuck with the face and body that I have. I'm not using any prosthetics, so I'm going to look like the other guys for sure. But in terms of soul, in terms of proclivities, in terms of worldview, in terms of feel, I think and I hope this is a very different guy from anybody you've known in any of the TV roles or movies that I've done.
Your first period piece in a way, right?
I guess
back to the 1960s.
Yeah.
David Duchovny, it's a pleasure talking with you. The new book is Holy Cow. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David, good luck. We'll look forward to hearing some of that album. We'll look forward to Aquarius. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Listeners, thanks for all your questions, all your input right here. Thanks for joining us today. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.